With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Brash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
I just want to start this broadcast with full disclosure here very quickly. My special guest today, Phil Ferguson, and his show, The Phil Ferguson Show, are occasionally a sponsor of this broadcast. So yeah, Phil occasionally does sponsor The Thinking Atheist. And I just want to draw a big circle around that up front and make sure everybody knows that that is the case, okay? But unlike my other sponsors, and I've got some great ones and I'm thankful for them, you know, unlike NatureBox and HelloFresh and Harry's Razors or whoever, Phil is an active part of the movement, and he has been for many years, and he serves a specific conversation in this movement that I don't hear a lot of. He talks about skepticism in regard to finances. And so I'll see him give a presentation somewhere, you know, at the Gateway to Reason event or wherever, and then I'll corner him at his table in the lobby, and we'll just talk, and I'm just pawing at him with questions. And we'll get on the phone, and I'm pawing at him with questions about this kind of stuff. And I thought, if it's interesting to me, it's probably interesting to a great many people in our audience. And as every show that I do kind of has a different angle to it, you know, we try to cover different topics and different shades of skepticism. I think, well, you know, skepticism and finances, yeah, that might be interesting to a lot of people. Now, to make sure that this sort of niche show isn't going to interrupt the regular show schedule, you know, this is not on the normal podcast roster, this is actually going to be a bonus show. So if finance isn't your thing and you're not interested in talking about 401ks and mutual funds and retirement planning and saving up for your college education or your kids' college education, if this isn't your thing, no problem. This is an extra show on the roster, so you won't be missing anything. And for those who are interested, the information, the conversation, the opinions and perspectives here are here for your benefit. This conversation originated as a video interview, so if you'd like to watch it, the YouTube link is in the description box of this show. Phil, it's great to have you. Thanks for joining me for a few minutes for this video podcast.
Hey, thank you very much. Anyone who knows me knows I'll accept almost any invite to speak. So,
are most people like me, Phil? I mean, you start talking about Foxworthy who said, Jeff Foxworthy said, when he hears mutual funds, he just thinks everybody's having a good time. That's sort of how I approach many of these
things. Well, I think one of the things that's unfortunate is that there's no system for education. There's no high school or college classes that I'm aware of in general, unless you really seek them out, to teach you how things work, how to money, I like to call it. And so you end up in a situation where you're undereducated. And unfortunately, the vast majority of the industry doesn't benefit by you being educated. They benefit by you not understanding so they can separate you from your money.
That was my next question. Is it like, I realize much in the law has to be written in a specific way that perhaps only attorneys can really navigate. But it also seems like much of the way that the law is presented and written is designed to lock out anybody who's not an attorney who wants to know what the hell's going on. You know, it's a way to sort of make it a small club where only a few people can play and the rest of us have to pay for their services kind of thing. And I find the same as with finance. I mean, is that accurate? Well, is much of the industry designed to make me feel stupid?
Well, funny that you mentioned, being locked out 20 years ago when I thought I wanted to start doing this. I studied for a Series 7 brokerage license and I registered with the state to take the test and they said, who's your sponsor? And I said, what do you mean, who's my sponsor? You have to have a currently existing broker-dealer sponsor you to be a broker. And so I called a few broker-dealers, and they laughed me off the phone because why would they sponsor me? I'd just end up being their competition. So I could not actually get in the industry unless I went to work for somebody until I found out about the program called Registered Investment Advisors, which is a slightly different license, but it's basically the same material. So there is that lockout. And the story I always love to tell about a friend of mine came to me one time and said, Phil, I finally took your advice and I bought a stock. Now, the first thing wrong with that is that part of my advice would be to talk to me. So she didn't follow that. The second part was she bought one stock. She only had $5,000. And this was a lady who was about to be foreclosed on her house. She stopped paying her mortgage because she knew she couldn't make the full payments. And she'd saved up $5,000 and she bought a stock and she told me she got it for half price.
Was this like the lottery for her? She's like, I'm going to strike it big and then pay everything off.
Well, that's how she thinks of it, because someone came to her and told her that this is a way for her to make a lot of money. And we researched the company and I found on their website this quote, and I'm going to give this to you here. They are working on a proprietary technology to harvest the constant and powerful static electricity that has continually formed in the Earth's atmosphere. So they are going to float helium weather balloons up several miles, tethering them to the ground, and they're apparently going to collect static discharge. And of course, anyone knows the only time there's a really good difference in static electricity is during a thunderstorm, and those balloons get shredded and they drop several miles of cable to the ground. And of course, they'll fall at high speed. What could go wrong?
Where do I invest? I mean, come on, give me the ticker number or whatever.
But she didn't look at this stuff and she just was told it was a deal. So I explained to her why it wasn't a deal, and that she basically had been ripped off. And I told her the language to use to go back to the broker. And she said that she couldn't do that. And I said that I would go with her and explain it to the broker, because if you threaten to file a complaint with the, in this case, the Illinois Securities and Exchange Department, they would happily give her $5,000 back because they don't want to deal with that. And she said, I can't do that because it's a member of my church and I don't want to ruin his reputation.
Oh my God. Well, some of that would be, it'd just be intimidating to have to go back and try to speak this language, you know, to defend why she should get what the legalities are about getting her refund or about her getting her investment dollars back. She wouldn't know where the lines were drawn, you know, so it'd be a good thing to have you by her side.
And this is one of those stocks, for anyone who's watched Wolf of Wall Street.
I was going to ask you about the film. I'm so glad you brought it up. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Phil. Go ahead.
There's a scene in there where they're talking about these pink sheets or off-market or thinly traded stocks, which this was one of. And the broker, by law, there is a law, the broker can make a commission no greater than 50%. Yes, there's that dramatic
50%
pause.
Commission 50%. Sounds like a sweet gig.
So, she put in $5,000. I don't know what the broker actually made, but it can't be by law more than $2,500. So a lot of products have 3, 5, 10, 15% commissions. Some life insurance products, you might pay $15,000 a year for a long-term care insurance. And the commission for the salesperson is the first year's premium. So they might make $15,000 or $20,000.
Are all pink sheets called penny stocks? Are they one and the same?
Yeah. What happens if you're on a big listing like New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ, there's certain criteria that you have to meet. And those include price, number of shares, value of the corporation in total, and a couple of other things. If you don't meet those criteria, you basically get what's called delisted and you go on the pink sheets. Usually those stocks are a dollar or less. That doesn't have to be. You can find ones that are more than a dollar, but often they're very low price. And if you buy something for 50 cents and it goes to 55 cents, it's only a nickel, but you just made 10%. But if you have to pay a 50% commission to get in, it's really hard to cover that.
So the idea is that I spot a stock and it's a penny a share. And if it skyrockets and goes to a dollar, $2, $10, I'll never have to work again for the rest of my life. This is the appeal, yes?
Yeah, that's the appeal. And what I've heard people say when I tell them the odds of that happening are slim to none. And they say, well, it's only $5,000. And if I lose $5,000, I don't care. And to that, I'm like, I don't fucking understand. I've never in my life ever had $5,000 that I didn't give a shit if I lost it.
So they treat it like Vegas? You know, tables thing?
It's a flyer. You know, it's like, I also, my entire life, I've never bought a lottery ticket. I don't get it. I know the math. That's the problem in the math on these things. And where people get in trouble is they'll buy a stock and then they go on the internet and they try to do what's called pump and dump. They try to drive up demand and spread rumors that something's going to happen with the stock. And then it goes up a quarter or a nickel or dime or whatever, and then they sell it. Of course, you can get jail time for that. So that's not cool either.
Back to The Wolf of Wall Street. What was your take on the film? Did you like it? Was it Hollywood? Was it accurate or some of both?
It was mostly accurate, from what I know of the story. I'm not a certified expert in that specific story, but the information about the industry and how it works seemed to be pretty reasonable. The vast majority of people, as I said earlier, they are paid to sell something to you. You know, the example I make, Seth, that people, almost everybody has a car or has bought a car. If you go to the Chevy dealer and you ask them what's better, a Chevy or Ford truck, what are they going to tell you?
Sure, a Chevy.
You know that, and that's okay. You build that in, and you have that understanding. When you go to a large brand name brokerage house and you have an advisor, I can do scare quotes because we have video, an advisor, they aren't really your advisor. They're paid by the company to sell you something, and their brokerage house may have a deal with 5 or 10 or even 15 different mutual fund companies, and guess what? They're going to recommend those funds. So there may be something better, but if they recommend it to you, they don't get paid.
Well, I'm a total minnow in this, Phil.
Yeah.
I mean, if I walk in and I've got, I mean, to me, 5 grand might as well be 50 grand. It's certainly nothing I would say, screw it. It's just 5 grand. I would want to make sure it was going somewhere where it had a real potential of doing something, you know. But if everybody's got their own kind of dog in the fight, how do I bullshit proof my own investment? And you don't have to jump in necessarily with a pitch for you, but you're welcome to. But I want to know, is there anybody out there who's operating at least partially bias-free?
Well, I think the best chance you have is to look for someone that will eagerly embrace the fact that they are a fiduciary. Fiduciary means that they have a legal obligation, not just an ethical one, to represent you. So an advisor that is a fiduciary can still make mistakes. They can still be wrong. The market can still go down. That doesn't prevent any of those things, but they have a legal obligation to do what is in your best interest, whereas the average insurance person and the average broker only has to do something that is suitable. Do you know what the definition of suitable is in the finance world?
No.
There isn't one. I mean, you'd have to take pretty much an 85-year-old woman and she has $500,000 and you invest it in an oil well and she loses it overnight. If she hires an attorney and goes to court, she might be able to prove that you put her in an investment that is unsuitable. Anything short of that, it's just an argument that he or she said it was suitable and you thought it was not. So you want to find someone that's fiduciary. And what I tell people is, if you have an advisor, ask them, are you a fiduciary? If they say anything other than yes to that question, odds are they are not. Because a fiduciary has a whole bunch of extra stuff that they have to do to become a fiduciary, and they want to brag about it. They want to tell you that, yes, I work for you. As an example, and I'll do that little shameless pitch thing you suggested, I only get paid by people that hire me. I make no money from any other source, and that's how I registered with the government. And so if I did something contrary to that, I could spend time in jail. So you can ask for someone's filing documents or what's called their filing brochure, and it should disclose exactly how they can or cannot get paid. And some of them are very, very difficult to read. That's a lot of legal terms. But if it's straightforward and simple, it should say, I am a fiduciary. I only get paid by my clients. That's who I represent. Then it's real easy to at least eliminate some of that problem.
I just want to use fiduciary in a sentence. Throw it out in the middle of a party, you know, just so people
there,
hear me say.
There you go. Yeah. Well, you know what we could do, Seth, if you wanted to. I have a little fun math game we can do. You ready for some math?
Okay, hit me.
Do you have pen and paper handy?
I do not, but I'll give you what I got. Go for it.
All right. And so for the listeners, if you're driving, this might be the time to pause and pull over. You don't want to wait till you get home, but pull over at least. What I'm going to tell you about is a thing called a guaranteed mutual fund. And these comes around all the time, and they have an endless number of names. Sometimes they're called annuities, index annuities, variable annuities, fixed annuities, all kinds of things. But they guarantee your money. And of course, anytime there's a guarantee, there's cost to that. So what you're going to do is you're going to invest $100 in a sample. And 10 years later, you're going to have a 40% return So your expected net after 10 years is $140. You with me?
I'm tracking.
Okay. Now, there is a 72-page prospectus that the salesperson hands you, and you, of course, read all of it, and you pull out the last page and sign it, right?
No. Usually they summarize it. They tell me where the main points are. I nod my head and say thank you.
Yeah, kind of think of it as when you install the new Windows or new Macintosh or Apple operating system.
I click I agree just because I want to get the damn thing in.
So they tell you all the good things, that it's safe, it's bonds, it's stocks, it's really mature. You're going to make this 40%, which is 4% a year, which, by the way, mathematically is only 3.3% a year compounded. It's not actually 4%, but there's no requirement that the salesperson actually be able to do math. So there's that. Now, the first thing that you find out once you've bought this is there's an 8% load, which is the commission. That's how the salesperson gets paid. So you have to take $8 off what you expect to make. So the $140, you have to take off $8. And that load, that 8%, goes to the advisor. You with me?
I'm still tracking. So you're down $8 on your $150.
$140.
Forgive me.
Nice try, though.
I'm tracking. Yeah. I'm sorry. I should have used the pen and paper.
Yep. Now, the funny thing, Seth, now I'm going to ask you, how much money did you initially invest?
Well, let's see. I put $100 in to begin with, right?
No. You put $92 to begin with, because the $8 comes off the top.
Oh, so at the very beginning, it comes out of my pocket.
Well, everything comes out of the customer's pocket.
I'm just saying, right off the bat, when I'm making the investment, right at the beginning, that $8 is gone.
Right. So you thought you were going to make $40 or 40% on your $100 investment, but you never invested $100. You invest $92. So you don't make $40. You make $37. So you have to take off another $3.
And all of this speaks to how much I can actually make. And now that the investment itself is diminished, my earning potential on the investment diminishes as well.
That's absolutely true. And I'm just getting started. So average mutual funds have an expense ratio of 1.5 to 1.6, although you can buy an index fund that is below 0.1%. This one's a little higher than average. It's 1.8%. And you're going to pay that 1.8% per year, because if you pull out early like a good Catholic, there's a 10% penalty. So you've got to pay 1.8% a year for 10 years. That's another $18. Now, I told you it was guaranteed. And Seth, do you own a car?
Yeah, I do.
You have insurance on that car?
I do.
Right? I mean, you understand that there's a small fee to protect what you own. And that's just 1.5% a year. So that's another $15. And then we get to my favorite part. The bulk of this investment is in zero coupon U.S. bonds. You ever had those? You know what those are?
Nobody does.
But the classic bonds back in the day, they used to have little pieces of paper at the bottom, like if you want to get rid of free kittens, you know, and you pull off a little tag and call the phone number when you get home.
Mm-hmm.
And you turn those in at your bank. That's why they're called coupons, whatever they're called. Well, zero coupon bonds pay no interest. They appreciate in value. So you might buy one for $8,000 and several years later sell it for $10,000. The IRS has decided they can't wait to tax you until you sell it. So they created a whole category called imputed interest. And they calculate the interest you would have paid, the interest you would have been paid if you were paid interest, and they charge you the tax on the money you don't have yet.
You understand why many of us would just reject the entire investment process.
But you didn't hear this part. That's why it's not sold this way.
Oh, okay.
They tell you only the good things. I'm telling you, kind of like Paul Harvey, the rest of the story.
Right. Yeah, we're looking at the man behind the curtain here.
So. Right. And so that works out to about 0.8% per year. And the beautiful thing about the zero coupon bonds being set up this way is the company that buys them gets to keep the appreciation and you get to keep the tax bill. It's really clever. And so that's
Selling me on this, Phil. Selling it.
Yep. That's another $8 over 10 years. And so what you end up at the end, and for anyone who's kept along at home, you end up with a net of $88 after having this investment for 10 years.
And people get away with this? Is it just the ignorance of the investor? I mean, is it a lack of regulation? How does this happen?
Well, I think it's a little bit of ignorance of the investor, because at some point the investor has to be responsible for their investments, but it is all totally legal. You could argue it's immoral and unethical. And the watchdog organization for the industry is called FINRA, FINRA, in case anyone wants to Google it. And it's staffed by people from inside the industry.
No, the industry is supposed to regulate itself.
That's right. And the industry regulates itself just barely enough that that combined with their political donations keeps the Congress off their back. So you can actually go look up FINRA and Google FINRA guaranteed mutual funds, and you can see all of this information. If you still can't find it, send me a link. They can email me, phil@polarisfinancialplanning.com. I actually have people accuse me of making this up because it's so ridiculously bad it can't be true. But the watchdog organization actually puts up has a webpage called Investor Warning Page, and they give all these details, and they tell people not to buy them while all of their member organizations go out and continue to sell them. It's like the label on cigarettes that says it causes cancer. They've warned you, and now you're on your own.
You mentioned Polaris Financial. You want to tell me about that? I mean, is it sort of the hub of your radio show, or do you do 50-50 financial interviews, or what?
Well, the Phil Ferguson show is about one-third finance and about two-thirds atheism. I want it to be entertaining and lighthearted, and an hour at a time of just money talk is kind of painful for most people. So I'm trying to find, and I have my niche, the atheist movement. I became an atheist at 13. Never really felt like I needed to do anything until I spent a couple of years in Arkansas. It's the state right below Missouri. Mm-hmm. And I saw what government was like when it was run by religion. And I vowed that I would do what I could to help out that situation. And since I had some money, I started donating to conferences. And at some point, they suggested that I should table. And my first thought was, what the fuck does a finance guy do at an atheist convention with a table? And that was kind of the response for most people that walk by. And over the years, a few people would come up and say, well, you're promoting yourself to atheists, and you are an atheist, and you supported this convention, and I have an advisor I already don't like. Can I switch to you? And the first time it happened, I thought, wow, I never actually thought I'd get business out of this, because people credit me with having this genius business model, but it's kind of some just stupid luck. I was doing something I loved and promoting the movement, and now it just keeps growing and growing and growing, and it seems like the more evangelical atheist I become, the more clients I get from the movement.
Well, I saw you speak. I mean, you spoke in St. Louis and you spoke in other places. What are you doing? Are you talking finance from the stage? Hey, everybody, you're getting swindled kind of thing? Or
well,
what are you pitching?
I think of myself kind of like some of the stuff I'm doing here on this show as a consumer advocate. I'm going and presenting the mathematics of how things work. Matter of fact, I have another show where I go through and I dissect a very specific annuity product. People tell me all the time that they hear other advisors say don't buy annuities, but they never explain why. And the reason why was that it took 25 minutes to give one simple example of the mathematics involved. And I think that's show number 119, and I also followed up on that in show number 146, where Elizabeth Warren, congresswoman from Massachusetts, published a report about kickbacks and what advisors can get, vacations and luxury items for selling certain products. Another thing is socially conscious mutual funds, very, very big in the secular liberal world, but they're a complete waste of your money. You end up with far less money in your investments. And by the way, you're not doing any good whatsoever. And that freaks people out. And they can hear that in show 120. And then the one that I thought was most amazing, long-term care insurance. And this is where investing or the finance community becomes kind of like religion. They scare you. They provide a solution for you. They take your money and provide nothing in return. So long-term care insurance covers the nursing home. So when you finally get 80, 85 years old and you can't take care of yourself, and people are terrified, they spent their entire year saving money and investing, and it's going to be wiped out. And it's very terrifying. So they sell this insurance, and I go through a whole episode. It's I think it's show 134 that explains all the mathematics of that. And a few fun facts, only about one-fourth of all people ever go to a nursing home. Sometimes people die like in car accidents, or they get ill and never leave the hospital. Things happen. So most people never even go to a nursing home. And then the average life expectancy in a nursing home, unfortunately, is 1 year and 2 months. So you're buying insurance for something that is very rare to happen. And even if it does, there's limits on how much they're going to pay. And the limits are such that if you had invested all of the premiums that you're paying for the long-term care insurance, you could actually end up with more money, even if you do go into a nursing home.
Let's come back to a couple of things you threw out. And again, many in the audience are going to be looking at all this through my eyes. You know, I am presented with these sort of big picture concepts. Stocks volatile, mutual funds stable. And mutual funds may not return you, have quite the return potential, but they're more secure. You say mutual funds are something we should avoid outright. Now, I know I'm not going to ask you to do the 30-minute show, but can you give me just a morsel of the meal here? What are we talking about?
Sure, sure. Well, with any type of investment, there's risks, whether it's inflation or volatility or changes in interest rates. With a stock, if you buy one stock for one company and it's called Enron, the most you can lose is 100%. That's the limit. The way you virtually eliminate specific stock risk is what it's called, is you buy a whole bunch of stocks. You can buy 20, 30, 40, 50. Most people that do their own stock investing return about minus 4% compared to the market because they regularly buy high and sell low. When a stock loses, they get rid of it. So one of the ways to avoid that, or if you have no idea what a 10K report is or how to read a profit and loss statement, you get a mutual fund. They do all that for a fee, and they tend to underperform the market about 2%, which is equal to them matching the market minus their expenses. It's the number you would expect them to make. But an index fund basically matches the market, keeps the cost as low as humanly possible, keeps your tax consequences lower, but you still have stock market risk. And the worst example in our recent history is in 2008, the U.S. stock market went down 37%. But we also had a 95, it went up 38, and I think it was 2012, it went up 32%. So the way to get rid of stock market risk in the short run is to be a long-term investor. And Seth, if I understand correctly, you're what, like 40 years old?
Oh, you're very kind.
So yeah, you could live 30, 40, 50 more years. You are a long-term investor. And so if you look at just a 10-year time frame, and we'll see how you can do this math in your head. You ready for more math?
I'm ready.
I know, it's right. Every show is like this for me.
Go ahead.
You invest $10,000 in the stock market, the S&P 500. And listeners, you can go double check this on Wikipedia S&P 500. It's part of why what I do, science-based investing, because you can double check. If you happen to invest at the single worst year, 10 years later, your $10,000 turns into what? How much money do you have after 10 years? I'll give you a hint. It's less than $10,000.
Wait, the idea is if I buy low, everything crashes. Now's the time to jump in.
Right, but no, when I say you bought at the worst time, you bought at a peak.
Oh, I see. Forgive me.
You bought at the worst time for you.
All right, I get it. I'm tracking.
So instead of $10,000, 10 years later, how much do you think you have? You would actually lose 13%.
Okay.
So your $10,000 turns into $8,700. And of course, investing for an entire decade and still having less money is heartbreaking. That's what scares people. But what is the best 10-year time frame? You invest $10,000. 10 years later, how much do you think you have?
I don't know. I double or triple it.
You know? Okay. It actually goes to $57,990.
Well, how do I get that deal, Phil? You know, that's what I'm saying. Well,
the good skeptic, what they say to me, they say, Phil, I can't possibly count on my money going from $10,000 to $58,000. And they're absolutely right. But the odds are the same that you would lose 13%. Those are the best and the worst case scenario in the last 47 years when you own for 10 calendar years. The odds are, once you go out to 10 years, that your return is going to be 10%. Plus or minus 3% to two standard deviations. So the odds start to get more and more.
Standard deviations?
Yeah.
It sounds.
It just means that, three quarters to four fifths of the time, you're going to be in that range.
All right.
And when you go out to 25 years, odds are your return is going to be between 12 and 8. 95% of the time. So it gets more and more reliable the longer you invest. That's one of the ways you eliminate stock market risk is time. It's a very important thing. So if someone calls me and says, Phil, can you tell me I'm going to make 20% next year? They're probably not even suitable to be a client of mine because how do I explain that to them that it's not possible?
Well, they have you're also unrealistic. Probably looking, if someone's looking at, you know, hoping to make that much in such a short amount of time, you're possibly dealing with an emotion-based investment, right?
Right. And another thing that people do all the time is they switch mutual funds. And Vanguard did a study. If you Google Vanguard white paper, Chasing Performance, I believe it's called, they did something like 5 million investment paths. And they created two scenarios. One was basically buy and hold. And the other one was buy and sell if your mutual fund is doing worse than average. And if your fund is doing worse than average, you then go buy one of the best funds and you actually hurt your results. You make 2.3% less per year by doing that. Because you're basically, you're selling low and you're buying high. You're buying funds that just perform great. Well, that's nice to know, but that was for the last 1, 3, or 5 years. It doesn't predict what they're going to do. Actually, it can be a kind of a counterintuitive predictor. Funds that do really, really, really well tend to underperform the index going forward because the market changes and it swings. Often skeptics get tied up on this idea of like a coin toss. If I get 3 or 4 or 5 heads in a row, the odds for the next time is still 50-50. That's true. But that doesn't work that way with markets. It does for specific stocks, but if you buy a whole market, they do regress to the mean.
So I'm trying to picture the audience members now. I mean, are they engaged? Are they shaking their head? Are they nodding? Are they like, wow, I've never heard this before? Are they glazed over? Are they cussing me? I have no idea. But I have another question I want to throw out.
Yeah.
And this is based on something that you had said last month or the month before when we were speaking on the radio. We were pitching your show and kind of talking about the broadcast. But you said that it's a bad idea to save up for your child's, or maybe I'm phrasing it incorrectly, so correct me. It's a bad idea to save for your child's college education. Help me out with this, Phil.
Well, of course, if they go to the Phil Ferguson Show, the brand new episode 160 has a complete description of this and my philosophy on it. But there's a couple things that are at play here that if your child's university that they pick to go to counts the 529 or the college savings fund as money available, and one could argue that it is available because there it is and it has their name on it, you could actually hurt their ability to get grants, waivers, and tuition adjustments from that university. It doesn't affect the federal numbers. Those are calculated a different way. The other thing that's a real big problem is that 529s have a bad history of underperforming even the average mutual funds. And when you get to the point where your student is 3, 5, or even 10 years from college, you do want to start investing more and more conservatively so you can make materially more money in the long run if you invest that money in your retirement account than you would in your student's account. So you want to maximize your IRAs, Roth IRAs, 401ks, all those things. And then only then, if you still have money and you just make so much income that you're never going to get any aid anyway, then you can consider a 529. Otherwise, for most people, don't do it. Focus on saving 20% for yourself. And apparently, my listener's favorite phrase, I almost didn't even get it in this show. People hear all the time, you got to save 10%. I tell them that 10% is the suck-ass minimum. You really got to get close to 20.
We'll put that on the website. We'll see how that goes over.
10% will work if you start when you're 22. But for most people, they didn't save when they were 22 or 25 or 28 or even 30. So if you don't want to wait 40 years to retire, 10% is not going to cut it. Just the way the math works out.
All right. Well, we got a couple extra minutes here. What are a few of the other things that the layperson gets wrong? I mean, what are some things that we misunderstand or we do incorrectly that, you know, if you could course correct some folks, you would do so? What would that be?
Well, I think probably the biggest thing is if you were sold something, if you wanted life insurance, you should get term life insurance. And I often have people contact me that say, Phil, why do I need life insurance? And I go, why are you asking me? You tell me why you need life insurance. If you can't think of a reason, you may not need it. Usually, in my opinion, is that if you're married and your spouse is dependent on your income, or you have kids that are dependent on you, life insurance is a pretty good idea. But you want to follow the age-old saying, buy term and invest the rest. You would never go buy car insurance that also invests for your retirement. So why do you buy life insurance that invests for your retirement? I had a gentleman come into my office many years ago. He was 60 years old. He wanted to retire in 2 years. And he had a life insurance policy, very complicated product that had a $100,000 value if he died, and it had a $30,000 cash value. And that's one of the keys. If you look at anything and it says cash value, and if it's insurance related, my basic recommendation is you probably shouldn't own it. And he came to me and said, well, I pay $500 a year for this $100,000 of life insurance. You can't do that at the age of 60. That's not how the math works. So I called up his insurance agent, and he says, oh, he pays in $500, and we take the other $5,000 out of his cash value. And so I had to turn to the guy in my office and tell him that if he didn't hurry up and die, he would have no life insurance. So if he didn't die within the next 5 years, his life insurance policy would either cancel, or he would be able to pay the full premium of $7,000 a year, but he didn't have the money.
How is this not a scam, Phil?
Well, I didn't say it wasn't a scam. I said it's legal. There's a big difference between unethical and legal. Another thing that people make a big, big mistake about, and I'm delighted that this popped into my head, 401ks. People change jobs and they think, I'll get around to moving my 401k at some point. Do that sooner than later. I had a couple last year that were both in their early 60s. They had 15 old 401k accounts. Five of the companies that they used to work for are now out of business. And so the amount of time and effort that you may have to spend to find and collect and move your own money is unbelievable. And they got so frustrated with the amount of work that was involved with this that they said maybe they should just put it off. And I said, if you're having trouble doing this when you're 63, how are you going to do it when you're 70? You need to organize this. And I had one friend of mine, his former employer changed the 401k provider. And his $100,000 just got reduced by $5,000 in fees because all of the new funds had a 5% front-end load. So you don't want to leave the money behind in old 401ks. Or even worse, you move a couple times and they lose track of you and you lose track of the money. I've actually had clients lose six-figure accounts. They don't know where they are.
It hurts my heart, man.
It is truly amazing. They go, I had this job once. I worked there 10 years, but I left like 15 years ago, and I haven't seen a statement from them in years. Well, did you move? And they're like, yeah, we moved twice since then. Okay. That might have something to do with it. So it can be a whole lot of legwork to go back and figure out and validate that you are who you are to collect your own money.
Let's talk a little bit about kind of the mindset of skeptics, quote unquote skeptics. You know, from time to time, I hear someone say that, you know, atheists are all skeptical. That's why they're atheists. And I think you haven't seen my inbox, right? They're atheists. No one knows how or why they came to atheism. It might've been for non-skeptical reasons. You know, they might believe aliens killed God, for Pete's sake. I have no idea. But your sort of philosophy, for lack of a better word, is applying the skepticism that we point toward religion and point that in the other aspects of our lives, including finance. Yes.
Well, absolutely. And it's been a growing thing in the skeptical movement. I mean, we started with Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster, and we go to UFOs and psychics, and then we spread out to homeopathy and general medicine and supplements and all these things. Well, why not investments? Why not take a look at that and demand rigor, demand some kind of clarity that my investments are going to do a certain thing or behave in a certain way? And why not have an advisor that is a fiduciary? It just popped in my head. When I was growing up, I'd learned that my dad was a stock picking genius until after my first year of college, he sat me down to show me where all the money was. And I learned that he wasn't. And he had this one stock. And I asked him, I said, what happened to this stock? And he says, well, it lost 99% of its value. I said, why have you never sold it? He said, it would cost more to sell than it's worth. And I thought, he never told that story at the dinner table.
Is it true, Phil, though, that, you know, you can put a broker and a chimpanzee in a room filled with stock picks and they kind of wash out? Or is that just a story they tell?
Well, it's funny because, yes, that works. And I've also heard, you know, chickens walking in the New York Times and where a dog takes a crap. It's very, very tricky to pick stocks. Virtually nobody beats the market by picking stocks. And people all the time, they'll point to Warren Buffett. He has beat the market, but he is not picking stocks. He's buying wholesale companies that are distressed or that he sees can be completely revamped. And he goes in and he takes over the company and reforms the entire company. Seth, unless I'm mistaken, you and I, we're not doing that. We don't have that option to put $500 million or a couple billion into a company and go in and reorganize it. So as far as stock picking, he doesn't even count. It's very, very difficult to do. And it's very difficult to do over time. And where most people make the mistake is they fail to account for A, the time that they spend doing the stock picking, like if they're a day trader. If you can make $50,000 or $100,000 a year as a day trader, assuming, let's pretend for a moment that you can, you're forgetting that you're spending all day every day doing it. You're forgetting the risk that's involved. And I've lost track of how many people I've known that have made a fortune in day trading and then had to go back to work. Because at some point it goes wrong.
So at one point, does this not become just guesswork? I think, you know, if the broker's in it because he's representing a certain brand and he's pitching that brand, and if most brokers are sort of on par with chance, how do I sort of bullshit proof or at least stack the deck in my favor a little bit? Everybody wants to get rich. I'm just saying, I just don't want to lose money. I want to come out ahead and actually make a return on my investment. What do I do with that?
Well, two really good books just popped in my head. The first one is called The Richest Man in Babylon. It's a very easy, simple read. It's stories. It's not a whole lot of math. It is meant for someone who hasn't really figured out how to save or why to save. It's a great, great beginner book, and it's very easy read. And then if you want my Bible, I'm going to hold it up for you here and see if the video works.
Common Sense on Mutual Funds by John C. Bogle.
And John C. Bogle is the founder of the Vanguard Mutual Fund Company. And no, sadly, I don't get paid anything to keep saying how wonderful Vanguard is. But that book, that's not a romance novel. It's not a spy thriller. You cannot sit down and read it in 4 to 6 to 8 hours. It's a textbook, and you need to sit down and go through it chapter by chapter, take notes, ask questions, search the terms on a good dictionary at thesaurus and find out what you're reading about. But when you finish that book, you'll know more than 95% of all investors, that one book.
Screw that. I'm just going to call you. Three in the morning, I got a question. Hey, Phil. I got a question.
So. Well, almost every week, the Phil Ferguson Show has a segment about investing or finance. And as you mentioned, so many of the people who are making the world better through atheism on the show. So it's a fun and entertaining show. If they have questions, they can contact me, phil@polarisfinancialplanning.com. But they can listen to the show episode after episode and get all this information for free. And people ask me all the time, why do you do it for free? Well, that's what I want to do. And so I've kind of lived my life by doing whatever the fuck I want, and it has kind of worked out okay because, you know, when I give a talk to a couple hundred people, there's usually a few people that come up afterwards and say, Phil, I want to hire you. And I said, I just told you how to do it for free. And they said, yeah, but I don't want to. It's just like, I don't want to change the oil in my car. I know how to, but I'm not going to. And some people don't like to mow their lawn, so they hire a lawn service. There are different things, and we live in a society now where we can take advantage of the luxury of, different people have different labor, and they become experts at it, and you get all the benefit from that by hiring somebody.
I buy that. You know, life gets crazy. I mean, it's nothing I would want to manage. It doesn't fit my temperament. I would just glaze over.
Yeah, and it's one of the things, if nothing else, for most people, me preventing them from doing something really stupid is where the money is at. But I do have occasionally people call me and they say, well, Phil, I'm already doing everything that you said I should do. Why in the hell should I pay you? I said, I didn't say you should. If you're already doing what's in the books that I recommended and or what I would tell you to do, then go do it for yourself. But a lot of people are busy and they have a job and they have a family and they got other things to do. And some people simply just do not want to fuck with it. and that's why they hire
me. I buy that. You know, I respect that. You play your cards up front and say, you don't need me, but if you want me, I'm here and I can help. You know,
well, and that's one of the things that if you have an advisor for fun, ask them how much they get paid from your investments. If they start answering the question as if it's Bill Clinton talking about Monica Lewinsky, you know they're dodging the question. For me, it's very simple. It's 1% per year. You can think that that's ridiculous and not pay it. You can think that it's okay and pay it, but you know, and you can make an educated choice.
All right. Fair enough. Bill Ferguson, I'll make sure and include the link to your site and show in the description box of this broadcast so that people who want to know more can know more. And, you know, thanks for sort of helping us navigate some of these waters. Again, I know we've not even dipped a toe in the ocean, man. It's just, it's a lot overwhelming, but it can be navigated with some perspective and some help from people who know what they're talking about. And probably a big portion of that is not rushing in. Right? Take your time, do the homework, figure it out.
You know, it's one of those the old sayings, there will be another trolley. So when I tell people, if you're sitting with a salesperson and they say, if you don't invest in this by Friday, you know, this is so good, the company's going to take this away. You've got to get this now or you're going to miss out. You shouldn't leave. You should run out the door.
That's a classic sales technique anyway. You know, I got another buyer on the line. If you want to buy this thing, you're going to have to sign right now.
That's right. You know, that's another thing that's different with the skeptical community. Investment advisors are often told through publications and magazines, never tell clients that their investments are shit. You always want to tell them, there's something we can do better for you. Well, that's not how my brain works. So when someone hands me something that's a piece of shit, I tell them it's a piece of shit. And in the regular public world, it's like telling someone you've had the wrong religion for 20 years. They don't want to hear it. They'd rather be wrong and ignorant than fix the problem. That's why I love the skeptical community, because when I tell them that's shit, what they often will do is say, why is it shit? I want you to show me the math to confirm that it's crap. Once I've done that, then they go, now what do I need to do to fix it? I am willing to accept that I was mistaken. Now what's the better path? And there's always time to do that. Don't panic. Don't do anything in a rush and learn and understand what you're doing.
All right. Well, it's been interesting. I'm sure you and I will spend another hour on the phone sometime in the coming weeks talking about
you're
whatever
so
you know investment thing pops into my head. But I hope the listeners have enjoyed it. And again, I'll link to everything. Phil, thanks for your work. Thanks for helping to educate people about a subject that in this movement is not talked about all that often. I think you're filling an important niche. And I think it means a lot to a lot of people. So thank you, sir.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.